when the Buddha described the forces in our experience that are the roots of pain, suffering, distress, he described them in terms of three qualities that get translated as, the old Victorian translation was lust, hatred, and delusion or ignorance. The moderns slightly coolly have substituted grasping and aversion, or attachment and aversion, for lust and hatred. But more and more, as I know myself, as I see myself clearly, I'm like, you know, that old translation was pretty good, actually. You know, the Buddha recognizing that there are these impulses that move through us that that cause so much of the pain in life. He called them the three poisons, or the three fires, or the three roots of suffering. And one of the most important things to think about them, as we were hinting at in the meditation, is that these are like, I think of them lately a little bit as like, you could say viruses. You could also say like weather patterns. They are impersonal forces that live not in individuals, actually, but in ecosystems. They live in cultures, in families, in nations. They are reductions, in a way, of emotions. They're concentrated qualities. And seeing them in this way, it's a little bit like saying, you know, like I have these ailments because, you know, for my whole life I've been in a culture that eats a lot of sugar, let's say. And even if I'm trying not to do it now, and that is one thing that I try not to do, I was raised with it. You know, when I was in high school, I at one point had a phase where I had some ice cream after breakfast, and then I had more at lunch, and then I had a shake when I got home from school. I put a raw egg in it just to make it healthy, and then I would have ice cream after dinner, and then when everybody went to bed, I would stay up till midnight watching Doctor Who on the BBC public television channel, and have some ice cream. And so there you go, right? That's what I grew up doing. And if I was to notice in myself some illness, say, that I could connect to that, to the sugar, it would be a mistake to think of that as like my sin or my error. There's my mother, bless her soul in heaven, did her damn best to protect us from the demon of sugar, right? I wasn't allowed Captain Crunch or Lucky Charms. I've never eaten those things. I was allowed Rice Krispies and Kix and Grape Nuts, the three most boring cereals on the entire shelf. And the shelf has gotten bigger since I was five. They're still the most boring, pretty much. But it's still in me, right? I got it from somewhere. I contracted the poison. And that's just a habit of eating, right? We've contracted poisons that that we never would have invented had we been given the choice, right? We've contracted the poison of racism, the poison of misogyny, sexism, the poison of homophobia, the poison of, you know, tossing a gum wrapper out the train window and not thinking twice. how can we do that? We would not choose to do it. This is the level on which greed, hatred, and delusion are talking about. They're not talking about, you know, oh, here's this thing that you should learn how to not do. That's way too surface level for these things. You don't unlearn racism. Certainly you don't unlearn it easily. And you probably don't unlearn it willfully. What you do is you become aware of it constantly. You start to track it arising in your nervous system all the time. You notice when you go into a room that suddenly you notice who's here, right? And that just becomes second nature. You notice as you move through groups of people who you're drawn to and who you're afraid of. And all of that starts to arise. And we do this for a very long time, I think, before the deep habit of who I feel comfortable with and who I don't starts to shift. And long before it actually shifts, we start to behave differently. And I think this is why the ethical practices, like controlling your actions, are more foundational in the path than the transcendent or wisdom qualities. The first thing you do is you figure out how to act clearly, even when you don't want to. Because, as one teacher of mine was saying recently, you can't trust your impulses. This is a place where this path goes against a common teaching in the hedonistic communities I sometimes run in, which is to trust your instinct, to trust your impulse. Your impulse is actually largely colored by greed, hatred, and delusion. Not because you did anything wrong. Actually, just because you are who you are, where you are, and you inherited the karma of your family, and the karma of your race, and of your class, and of the people you came from. I'm trying to start this little business and figure out lots of stuff about being a little teaching entrepreneur now. And my friend who knows about things like that, he said, you know, Harvard Business School did this study, and they said the single strongest predictor of entrepreneurial success is not hard work, it's not, you know, enthusiasm or intelligence or even education. It was very simply privilege. In other words, if you come from money, you're going to make money, most likely, right? And if you don't, it's way harder to do so. We are not a very class-mobile society. All of this is a way to say that the person with success did not earn it, and the person who is being oppressed did not earn that. And more deeply now, the way the place the Buddhist system goes is you don't own anything, actually. Any of your good qualities, they're not yours. They're part of the ecosystem. My mom also trained me to be basically kind. And to whatever extent that worked, and I'm basically kind, I can't own that. She was kind. My dad was basically kind. I grew up in a basically kind system. And I learned to be kind. Funny that. I also grew up in a slightly repressive system, so I learned to be kind by being a little repressed. So, you know. But, again, you know, I did nothing to earn that. Part of the profundity of this is that at the heart of the meditation practice of noticing our states must be a practice of not identifying with them. In other words, you have to learn to observe yourself like an ecosystem and be like, oh, look, the pine beetles have destroyed, you know, 40 hectares of forest. That's sad if you like living forests, as I do. And you can even say, and there's causation, right? You could say, oh, maybe because global warming, etc., da, 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 there's more pine beetles, maybe because we did something with how we managed forest fires or animals, or we killed the wolves, so then there were more rabbits, and then who knows, right? But that doesn't mean that anybody owns that phenomena. It's just arising. And so what you have to do with yourself in this practice is to essentially observe the ecosystem and say, oh, look, this is a mind that does not know how to settle. This was a hard realization for me. It took decades of practice to be like, oh, look, I'm actually not that good at focus. And I realized that about, you know, fairly quickly, I think. Actually, I thought that everyone was probably like that. It turned out to be not the case. But for a long time, I just figured it was my fault. I was like, oh, well, I kind of suck, but I'll work really hard. That was my way of still beating myself up, but trying to be noble about it. Right? I suck at this, but at least I'm patient. That was my thing. It took a long time to be like, oh, this is a quality that's not mine. This lives in my entire generation in a different way than the preceding generations or other cultures, other places. And this is all coming back to our conversation this month about trauma and the nervous system. Because a basic definition of trauma is painful experience in the present that is physiologically an echo of a wound that happened in the past. In other words, I was hurt once upon a time, and I'm still feeling it now. And particularly in the way that the nervous system, as we've been talking about, works. Our nervous system as animals says, I'm either at ease, or I feel threatened and I'm activated into protection, or I feel like my life is in danger and I'm shutting down. Right? Orientation and ease, activation of fight and flight, freeze, collapse, shutdown. These three primary states of the nervous system. In the same way as greed, hatred, and delusion are these fundamental qualities, markers of distress or styles of distress, of being distressed. Fight, flight, and freeze are the fundamental styles of feeling under threat or feeling distressed in the nervous system. And they correlate interestingly, but not exactly, the two lists of three. Sometimes I think about them. I'm cautious about automatically correlating contemporary discourse with ancient discourse. So I'm going to say that, take this with a grain of salt. But here's a proposal. If the nature of grasping is the impulse to move towards something or to sustain contact with something, and the impulse of aversion or hatred is, or the impulse of aversion is to get away from something, then some perhaps correlation to fight and flight, where the impulse of fight is to make contact, and the impulse of flight is to make distance. And then delusion and freeze go quite well together, actually. Where the quality of delusion is to not notice, is to be washed out, or quiet in a way that's not peaceful, quiet in the shutdown direction. So then trauma, in a way, is what happens when at one point we were threatened, either overtly, attack, etc., or subtly through attachment distress, developmental, incomplete developmental process, toxic environments of any kind. This is the way that all of those oppressions are traumatic. How could one come out of shutdown or out of fight and flight back into an oriented, open, feeling safe mode when there may have been very little concrete experience of safety? one of the most heartbreaking things about cultures who oppress is that the oppressed are immersed in the conditions that make it difficult to become unoppressed. Oppression isn't just a constant, isn't just the constant action of hierarchy or violence, but is the knowledge that there's no escape, or that escape is at least very, very difficult. The feeling of true safety is perhaps very, very difficult, and whole cultural mythologies arise to do whatever they can to tolerate that feeling, because that's an intolerable feeling, that there is no safety possible. And so, you know, songs arise. I remember when I was in my high school chorus, learned this spiritual, and I had sung it probably, you know, 100 times before I actually heard the words that I was singing. Soon I will be done with the troubles of this world. Soon I will be done with the troubles of this world. Soon I will be done with it. It's like, oh, that's a song about something I don't quite get, right? I'm like, yeah, I'm depressed and like kind of neurotic and miserable, but not like that, you know. But the song, which is a beautiful song, right, is an intelligent communal response to an intolerable situation. So here we are practicing, we're in our meditation, we're observing our state, and what we find is fluctuating qualities, right? Focus, the three I mentioned in the meditation, energy level, focus level, and emotional tone, are just a beginning to tracking our state, but they're useful in meditation to track. We can add to that, especially if we find ourselves drawn to working with the nervous system, or particularly if we find that we do not easily settle in meditation. If we find that the mind stays busy no matter what we try to do, or there's that subtle clench of distress no matter what we do, or no matter how calm we get, there's a level of vibration or discomfort that we never quite drop through. And if you don't know what any of those experiences are like, I don't quite know where you live, because this, you know, is the experience of most everyone I know now. So then what we get is we start to practice, and we're tuning into our state. And this, just to say technically, right, this is a different kind of practice than concentration practice in a very traditional way, where we would just say, connect with the breath and sustain that connection until the mind gets very still and radiant, and just keep relaxing. That's an instruction for the untraumatized. And God bless you, you people who can take that instruction and find pleasure in it quickly, or find success in it quickly. Most of us find the mind pretty wild, the emotional states pretty all over the map, or consistently unpleasant. In a certain way, what we're touching into, and this is why I think the nervous system material is so valuable as a support for the traditional meditation instructions, is that what we're touching into is not just distraction, and it's not just, like needing purification, or in a deep way it is, but it's too facile to just say, you know, oh, I'm. It felt very purifying today. Lots of anger. That's the kind of thing folks in my community say. They're like, oh, I was having a really hard time. You know, lots of purification. It really just means I didn't like it, but I think it was good for me. like, I'm going to sit through this painful thing. I'm just going to sit through it. I'm going to try to be mindful of it. Like, oh, I'm so mad and afraid. But I don't know what to do with it other than to observe it, because that's the only thing that the traditional instructions give. Because I think many of the traditional instructions assume the practitioner is way more healthy when they begin. And so, for those for whom practice is difficult, the practice then can turn to tracking the markers of these nervous system states. If what we're trying to do is to find what we would call deactivation, out of fight and flight, out of freeze, because if we're stuck in fight, flight, and freeze, we're actually not going to be concentrated or calm. Those things aren't available because we're working against our instincts. Our animal body is trying to say, I feel under threat, I must be vigilant, right? Like, the animal under threat doesn't want to sit here and close their eyes and get all relaxed. The animal under threat is like, there's the back door and there's the front door. The windows don't open. And the people are all looking at me kind of weird. Right? That's the vigilant animal. That's the fight and flight system activated. So I'm proposing that. What if we tune ourselves to that system and see if we can notice the qualities of activation? So then we start with eyes open, partly because it's grounding and it helps deactivation. If we were already in an activated state, starting with eyes open really helps that. And then once there's a little bit of ease, we drop inward just to the extent that the ease continues and see if we can sustain that ease as much as we can. When we find that there's not ease, we find the churning of the emotional body or intense distraction, which is going to be a cover to emotion often of some kind. What we can do is we can tune ourselves to, oh, there's, what's going on? Like, I can't focus tonight. What's really happening? And I want to feel into my state. And this is going to be kind of energy vibration. I'm feeling into energy and vibration. Activation essentially is a kind of vibration, or you can feel it as sensation. It's often uncomfortable. And we don't notice it. We're like, oh, I guess I'm just tired tonight, or I guess I'm just a little upset from that thing that happened earlier today. Here's the proposition. Don't dismiss it so easily. Turn toward it, and if necessary, with eyes open, if necessary, just a little tiny bit, but to say, oh, what is this? If this is fight, flight, or freeze, which one is it? Am I shut down or am I activated? It's like, oh, I'm activated. Cool. Am I activated in a kind of like lean in, I'm mad kind of way? Or am I activated in a kind of like, oh no, what's going to happen kind of way? Right? So am I on the fight side, which is the anger spectrum, or am I on the fear, the flight side, the fear spectrum? Same as always, right? Without judgment. Without judgment. Right? If you're a biologist and you're testing the pH in a body of water, you just want to know the number. And you might have a judgment that's like, you know, damn you, Chevron, or whatever, right? Whoever is changing the pH in the water, but you're not judging the water for being a different pH. You just want the number. Likewise, in the ecosystem of yourself, you just want to know. It's like, oh, where am I on the activation scale? I sense it, and then I see if I can hang out there. And the thing, as we've been talking about for a couple weeks, the thing that activation needs to deactivate is the perception of safety and a little bit of time. Basically, again, the animal just has to know that it's safe again. And so, oh, fear, fear is like this. What could I do in this very moment to offer to myself that I'm not, that I don't have to be afraid? So I might open my eyes. Am I actually under threat right now? Well, I'm not actually. Doesn't mean I'm not afraid of some people, perhaps, but I'm not actually under threat. What else? Oh, the evening light on the floor coming through that window. I always kind of like how the light reflects on this dark, kind of shiny floor. So then I purposefully let my attention rest there, and I'm like, okay, I'm a little afraid, but I really like the evening light. I want to let it in. I'm not trying to just like stay with the breath, but I just want to like turn to something pleasurable that's going to help me to be not lost in that fear. I'm not denying it. I'm actually quite still feeling it. But I'm mixing into it. You know, if your soup is too salty or too spicy, sugar will balance it. Put in a little maple, and it'll fix the excess spice or acidity or saltiness. I never thought of that metaphor before, but I thought it would just My baby got a shot this morning in the doctor's office, and he did great, partly because his mama fed him banana while the shot was happening, and sugar, to go back to sugar, is analgesic. It cuts pain. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, all of anyone who has dealt with sugar, the demon of sugar, knows this, right? Sugar cuts pain, physically, emotionally. But it actually does in this kind of direct way. Like, if he's tasting the sweetness, he won't feel the prick of the needle as intensely. So he did great with his little shot. He didn't like being undressed and weighed, but he did great with the shot. And of course, you know, you don't want to go too far with the, like, every time something painful is happening, have a bit of sugar. Mm-hmm. Right? Grasping something. So all of this is to say that I want to encourage you to bring mindfulness of state and nervous system activation more centrally in your practice. And I think this is actually a secret tool that can defang the habits of distraction that so haunt meditators. You don't have to struggle with the same unpleasant states over and over for decades. If you can learn how to get a little bit underneath what's happening and contact the fact that if your system was at ease, it would be at ease. And if it's not for a reason. And that reason can be contacted. And the very mysterious, this is part of the mysterious power of mindfulness. But with nervous system states of activation, they can be deeply habitual in our systems, but observing them without continuing to feed them through obsessive thought allows them to deactivate pretty quickly. This is very interesting. Observation and waiting deactivates rather than intervention. It's very hard to intentionally become unafraid or unangry. I know you've tried, because I have. What you can do is you can shift your attention and you can change the conditions in which that fear or anger is manifesting. And when the conditions change, the state changes. So. Next week we'll wrap up this trauma sequence. And talking some kind of a bit more subtlety, in a sense, about really working with our past, our histories, and the reality of harm in our lives and in our communities. So let's take just a moment to let it settle. Just open the floor for your reflections, questions, and interests. Yes, Sierra.
So you were saying you can understand that your ways of doing things are not yours.
Yeah.
Right. And that, and so I wonder, like, from there, what? What do you do with that?
Right, you realize that your ways of doing things are not yours, then what? A little bit that proposes that you've realized it, but you haven't completely realized it. In other words, you're gonna get caught again in identifying with something. According to the early tradition, if you realize that and really, 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 really realize it, you're done, essentially. Where done doesn't mean you go anywhere. It actually just means that all the stuff that is distressing to you becomes undistressing, right? And this is one of the ways of talking about being free. So then you just carry on, you know, having a great life. Being untroubled by things in the way that, you know, the way to... you know, the way to conquering aging, say, is not to figure out how to stay young, which is just, you know, a nice fantasy, is actually just to be not bothered by it. To be like, yeah, it's an ecosystem, right? This is a being that's going to age. And then you just kind of, you're done with it. You're like, yep, here comes frailty, you know. There goes strength and taut skin, you know? Cool. Like, what did we expect, right? We expected something else. So then we suffer constantly until we figured it out. So the process, in a way, one of my teachers said, everyone thought he was joking, but he wasn't. He said, letting go, I don't know what this letting go thing is. This is like one of the most respected teachers in this lineage. He said, I never let go of a single thing in my life. And what I take him to mean is you can't intentionally let something go, right? I couldn't intentionally right now be like, okay, stop being greedy for praise, let's say, right? I like when people tell me I'm doing a great job. There's no way I can intentionally stop that because it's a reaction. It's not a willful action. All I can do is notice it over and over and do things that might remind me that it's a source of suffering. Like, praise is one of the eight worldly winds. It says praise and blame will continue to blow through. You know, so sometimes people will be like, oh my God, you're awesome. And then sometimes people are going to be like, oh my God, you're terrible. And that's just going to keep happening, no matter how powerful you get or how oppressed. It's just going to keep happening. So then the practice is keep reminding yourself of that, that it's just wind blowing through. So a bit the thing to do, if it resonates for you, this particular teaching that you don't own things, is in a sense just to keep reminding yourself of that in finer and finer detail. To be like, oh, but what about like my unique gift of this? And then you might inquire into it. You'd be like, oh, what is that thing exactly? What is it? You know? Like, I'm a pretty good musician and I'm good at the composition side of things. I wrote chamber music when I was young. And my mom, who really believed in personal qualities, she was like, you're so talented. It's so great that you're so, we're going to put you in the gifted program. You know, she did this whole thing where she was like, you own that skill. And, but as I hung out with musicians, I was like, I'm not sure we own that skill. Like there's just these qualities that happen to exist in the body, like, oh, fine motor. Okay. And then something, but like lots of people have that. I don't have it more or less than some. It's just like, who am I to say that I own it? I would have to say that I own the body and my mind and my thoughts and all my parts. And the tradition says, if you think you own it, how come you can't control it or make it do what you want? And then, you know, and there's a deep conversation about what it means to have an identity at all. So really your question is the question that goes all the way. Right? It says, who am I actually? Right? And that's the beautiful inquiry at the heart of this whole thing. Right? Because the Buddha doesn't come out and say, you walk into a beginner class and he's like, guess what? You don't exist. He says, you know, practicing generosity rather than stinginess will make you happier. Acting to not harm people rather than harming will make you happier. It'll make your life more peaceful. Learning to settle when things are unpleasant is just better. It's nicer. Like he starts with really obvious stuff that you can't really deny. And then eventually is like, if you just follow those things all the way, those hints, then it's like, oh, I'm learning to tolerate discomfort and not get too fixated on pleasure because it's going to pass. I'm getting really down with change because it keeps changing. And at some point you're like, uh-oh. You know, because it goes down layer by layer by layer until you start hitting your like core personality. You know, the things you think of as yourself. And then you're like, oh, that sense that I have of being an individual that's observing other individuals, that thing also fluctuates, right? Like, oh, I get lost in the crowd and I forget myself and I'm just part of something else. I'm like, well, where'd the individual go? Or I get really high and where'd the individual go? It's like, who knows, you know? Or I get really, really depressed or really, you know, hooked in something unwholesome but that also is like, where'd this come from? What is this? You know, I don't even know myself in this state. And pretty soon it's like, oh, the thing I think of as me is also a constantly fluctuating quality. Or it's a set of qualities. There's no me there, it's just lots of qualities. And I'm like, oh, today I'm the happy, energetic, bitchy one. And then another day I'm the low energy, depressed, kind of existential fool. And it's like, which is me? So good question. Liberation question. Mm-hmm. That's what you do with them. Yeah. Yes, Peter.
Yes. I'm just thinking of activation of what's the not reversion, but like withdrawal, flight, not flight, but shut down. What's that one?
Yeah, like freeze.
Freeze
collapse.
And then at ease orientation.
Yeah.
So I was in this fairly intense moment long conversation hashing out, you know, some relationship dynamics with a very loved one. And I was observing all, you know, it's a very safe container. We can name things as they come up. But mm-hmm. we were both just, as we were naming things, all three of them were arising. There was like, anger! Oh, I can't look at you right now. I'm shutting down. I'm connecting with you right now. How are you? Yeah. And there's a baseline of love. So it wasn't like this gnarly thing. But yeah, all three were present in me and I think in the other person. And then throughout the next few days, there were like deeper layers unfolding of like, man, now I'm just really pissed off. Now I'm just like shutting down. But then I'm pissed off again. And so I was just noticing that I can be in any... I can have a... It was a like a combination. And I don't know what my question is other than I'm just noticing that maybe it seemed like, oh, I thought they were like these tiered things, but they don't feel tiered. They feel like I'm dancing in contact improv with these different things. And then I guess maybe if there's a question, it's sort of like what commentary on the navigation of the different states, and then like, you know, knowing like, okay, I'm probably, this anger feels like it's self-protection, but it feels appropriate right now. Like I do need the state, but then like, no, maybe there's too much, you know, right now that's not contributing, you know. Sure. I'm just exposing
it. Sounds great. It sounds great, man. You're doing it. We always want our inner experience to be more linear, you know.
Mm.
Like here's a chart and there's these three states, and I'm like, ah, now I'm shifting sort of in a linear way into the activated state. Now I'm deactivated, and it's like, no. It's because they're, because of course we call them states, but what they are is essentially sort of physiologically like, you know, gradations of chemical and you know, kind of neurochemical information happening. So one of the most challenging states, for instance, is like lots of activation chemicals flowing, like cortisol, I'm threatened, I'm stressed, you know, and then like I can't deal and I start to shut down, but I'm still kind of angry, but I'm kind of like, I'm sort of shutting down and my body's vibrating, but I'm kind of pissed and I'm kind of like, I can't really deal. And it's like, oh, it's just like I'm getting flooded with all these different things. And we'll call it flooded, you know. It's just true. So what you're describing is good practice, right? You're just tracking them as they, basically you're tracking whichever one is prominent, is most prominent,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you had none of the oriented state, you wouldn't even be able to track.
Mm.
You would just be like, ah! Right? If you can step back from that even a millimeter and be like, whoa, I'm hella angry, you know, then you have a teeny bit of orientation, right? You can even get into serious shutdown. I'll be, you know, some in the office with someone processing freeze. They'll be like collapsed in the chair, like practically drooling. And I'll be like, how's it going in there? And they're like, whoa. I'm almost like, I can't move. And I'm like, cool. What's it like? And they're like, kind of nice. Right? Because it's kind of nice. All of them are there for a reason. Right? Like you were saying, self-protection is appropriate, and it should feel, activation should feel good when it's appropriate. It feels good to defend ourselves.
Mm.
As you're saying, if it crosses the threshold into like, oh, this is inappropriate for the situation, then we can say, oh, there's some condition from the past that is causing my system to, say, overreact, for instance. There's this much threat, but I'm bringing in this much force.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going to be, oh, there's some fear or hostility in my system that's not connected to this immediate situation.
Right, right, right.
And that's when, you know, you could go psychodynamic here and be like, oh, we're fighting, but I'm actually fighting with my dad. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You know, it's like, oh no, you just became my, you know, it's like, so we notice that it's a way of saying there's what we could call trauma in the system. Yeah.
I was just hoping for a little bit of clarification and like wanting to like go over what I think I heard and see if that is right.
Oh, cool.
So like in talking about trauma response in our body and trying to come to a place of like safety and peace so that we can even like do the practice of focus.
Yeah.
You're asking us to maybe not let ourselves get lost in the swirl of that and just have to sit there in the suffering
yeah.
of it. But that we can like have a little spaciousness of it by like focus reshifting our attention to something that's pleasurable or
yeah.
to like come
yeah.
out of the trauma response a little bit is okay
yeah.
to not just have to like sit with it.
It's not only okay, it's the only thing that brings us out of it.
And that like by creating that spaciousness, then, but the, I guess my problem, like my, where I get hung up is that it doesn't make it go away. It doesn't like heal it, you know, it doesn't like change it. It just like temporarily like allows you to take a breath, maybe so that then you're better able to then like continue to sit with it.
Right. Well, we'd have to define what heal means. And I'll define it as the symptoms that are the present moment residue of past wounding arise less frequently, let's say, or less intensely. That's going to be the healing process. In other words, like, let's say I was, you know, I was wounded as a child, and the symptom I have of that now is a kind of, you know, anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Healing that from a trauma perspective is going to be not that, like, I figured out how to healing trauma is not the same as like a physical wound where it kind of stitches itself together and then you have a scar. Maybe it's a little bit like that, but like the healing almost would be like it doesn't hurt anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a scar. Maybe it's there forever. Of course it's there forever because it happened. But it doesn't hurt the same way. So what we're looking for is less anxiety. That's the definition of healing in relation to a past trauma, or less whatever the symptom is. And so deactivation, actually coming out of it, is healing it. What we'll need to then do is deactivate over and over and over, because it's a deep habit now, to the point where it gets triggered into intensity less often. And
we're relating to it differently.
We're not only relating to it differently, it's not arising in the same way. So here's a an example. Think of something that you were that was super important to you as a child or a teenager, say. You know, a band you were super into, or a TV show, or a food you really liked, or a childhood person you really didn't like. But just a strong preference that almost like defined your identity a little bit for a while, right? I was really into Doctor Who, as I mentioned earlier. And I really defined myself by it. I wore the costumes. I went to the convention. I did the stuff that you do when you are a Whovian in 1985. I know, it was very cute. I was cute.
You're cute.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Playing the praise.
Sweet.
Thing.
Praise. Yeah. I know. Don't get attached. Too late. But you notice this thing that you were attached to, and then where is it now? Even if you still like that thing, it's different now. You were grown up from that thing. Right? I never tried to dislike Doctor Who. I never tried to push it away. I just grew out of it. And even if I still like it, it's not the same. It doesn't define my identity. I don't feel the state of like longing for it or delight in it in that way. That's what I'll call healing. It was an important part of my life, and it's just gone. This is also what I'll call freedom or liberation. So for trauma, it's a little bit like when those habits are super stuck in there, this process of turning the attention, not denying them, but turning the attention towards something that will allow some deactivation. I settle a little more into ease. This is why, you know, for intense trauma, you know, a good therapeutic is not actually come to sit in silent meditation. A good therapeutic is like sit in a circle of people who share that experience and talk about it. Tell your story and be heard, right? Because that's much more conducive to the sense of I feel safe, I feel heard, I feel held in my pain. That's going to be a condition for deactivating,
mm-hmm.
right? In a way that like sit quietly, close your eyes, dive into it and hang out there, not so much. Right? That's not a good condition for deactivating. So you find the conditions for deactivating, and then when the state deactivates, and we're more oriented and present, like, oh, I feel safer now, then I think partly what you're asking is, then what? It's a little bit like Sierra's question, then what? What actually kind of uproots it or heals it? There may be, you know, other layers. Like, let's say I do a whole bunch of deactivation work, and then I can just hold what happened. Like, this happened, it's true that it happened. I was hurt in this way. And other qualities can come forward, mm-hmm. right? Like forgiveness or compassion.
Grief,
mm-hmm. right, will come. Grief won't come if I'm still activated. So I get deactivated, and then other layers will unfold that are actually wholesome. You know, I might go out and do a ritual. I might go and bury something. I might, you know, shave my head and start over. I might, you know, get a tattoo and, you know, go on retreat and call it done.
Yeah,
like, whatever.
I just don't want to, like, also, like, assuade responsibility somehow
mm-hmm.
for, like,
yeah,
oh, this
say more.
Isn't me. Like, oh, this isn't me. Like,
yeah. Yeah, that's the rub with that mm-hmm. with that question.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I'm just in an ecosystem, it's all just happening to me instead of like taking responsibility.
Yeah, so that would be going too far with that teaching. Or that would be taking on the words of that teaching without the feeling of it. Because you're still actually identified as a self. You're saying, "Oh, I'm just not that thing." So that's called spiritual bypass, right? That's like using the doctrine to escape feeling. The way through is more like keep feeling it. And it's actually going to be feel it more and more intensely as my range increases.
Ability to.
Yeah, like, oh, I can sit here through some discomfort. And at some point it's going to be like, oh, that thing happened. And it's going to be like, whoa. But once you've cultivated some skills, it's like, oh, that happened. And yeah, it's whoa, because that was real.
Yeah.
But you're like, I can hold it. And what you do, you might open your eyes, you might not retell the story, but feel it in the body. And if you can do that, if you're at the right dosage
uh-huh.
for yourself, feel it in the body and it'll settle. Mm-hmm. Because you're not actually being attacked in this moment. Right? The animal body kicks in. It's like, oh, I can feel it, not get hooked, and let it go. And we just keep doing that, and our range increases until, at some point, the thing that I was all about is actually just part of my story.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do all that without going to the disidentification piece.
Mm-hmm.
You can just be like, this is my story. I was wounded, I've been healing, and here I am now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an aspect of healing, I think, that this goes to, long before it goes to like, oh yeah, I'm just in an ecosystem. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Stephanie.
Just briefly, like, touching on all this is, to me, like, one thing that has been helpful in terms of the teaching of, oh, this is all just passing through me, I agree that it can easily turn into spiritual bypassing, but, like, in terms of being able to dig into these deeper states, keeping that in mind, like, just having this sense of, like, oh, this is all just passing through me, and I believe this, even though I don't fully understand that teaching or embody it yet, like, hopefully maybe one day, but, like, just the belief in it has helped me get to the places where I can dig in deeper to those states. Like, it kind of emboldens me to be like, okay, I believe this is true, but it's important that I still feel, like, everything.
Yeah. That belief gives you a teeny bit of safety, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, this pain won't kill me because I know what it is.
Yeah.
A little bit. And that gives you a little more range in that sort of range conversation. Yeah, Peter.
Well, I have a few thoughts. My first thought was what Peter spoke was also how our the socio-political thing that we live in, this society
is
constantly manipulating. I'm going to make you scared. I'm going to make you safe. I'm going to make you freeze.
Yep.
So like over and over and over
again,
all those buttons are being pushed like many, many times a day when we're looking at our Facebook. And first we see a kitten, and then we see a dead child, and then we see a terrorist attack, and then we see some strong guy saying, I'm gonna, you know, it's we're in a constant state of being manipulated. on that.
True that.
Those things. So that's, and that creates this great anxiety because you don't know what you're feeling.
Yeah.
You
know?
This is actually the link between this
yeah,
experience
you know,
of this
what
and
am I
Sierra's
feeling?
Thing.
I'm just feeling anxious. I don't even know what's going on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then with this, you know, with this conversation about when you said trauma is like that button that's pushed from something in the past.
Yeah.
Does not mean you don't get angry.
Yeah.
Or run, or freeze in an appropriate moment in the present. So there are things that will
hopefully
you should run from, and there are things that will make you angry, and you should fight against in the present.
Yeah.
But they're not colored by some. So I can, you know, not be afraid of every dog because I was bitten by a dog when I was 3. I can now know, oh, this dog is safe, and I can, or not, you
right.
know, or whatever, you know, that I can relate to the present
yeah.
reality and not be
yeah.
mm-hmm.
colored by
this
all
is the important piece because
mm-hmm.
if we're being constantly affected by states connected to the past, we're not actually accurately perceiving the present.
Right.
I can't tell the difference between a good dog and a dangerous dog
right.
if I'm afraid of all dogs because
right.
of the past.
Mm-hmm.
So attending to some of this healing gives me actually discernment in the present, you know, and I'm going to be like, oh, right, that habit of always getting together with the wrong person, heal that up somewhat, and then you're going to be like, ah, I have discernment for people. And it's like, ah, good person to hang out with. Oh, maybe not so much, I'm not sure, you know. And because we'll see more clearly,
yeah.
right, as this process happens. The thing you said about it being, you know, kind of culture is another piece in the direction of non-identification. It's like, oh, I feel this impulse to clear all the little numbers from my inbox and go on Facebook and just make sure that there's no little red dot with a number in it. I just have to clear all the red dots and then I'm okay. That's not just my OCD. They built that thing to do that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's on purpose.
Yeah.
Right? Because the longer you stay, the more shit you buy. And so again, like that anxiety, I don't own it. It's part of what's here, as you're saying. It's being not only put on us, but the state is being created.
Yeah.
Right? And so disidentifying from those aspects of it can be a beautiful and kind of joyful, in a way,
mm-hmm.
aspect of the resistance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that's a nice place to stop. It's our time. Resist. Hashtag resist. and this is a good direction that we're heading. So next week, I'll talk a little more about not on the absolute level of like freedom and disidentification and nirvana, but actually kind of our personal stories and our pasts and like the direct, concrete histories that are conditioning our present, and just some reflections in relation to working with that level of things. So onward. Again, philosophy course mid-July. Come and read texts with me. It's super good. Your generosity and donations absolutely support this group to persist in an anti-capitalist framework. Thank you for your donations of your resources in the basket on the edge there. And they get split in half between the studio and myself. So blessings to you. Keep in touch. Stay cool. See you soon.